Open Minds UFO Radio, another exciting show today. This is your host, Alejandro Rojas, and I have with me the lovely Jason McClellan. Hello, Jason.
Hello, Alejandro. I don't know that I particularly enjoy being referred to as lovely, but I appreciate it nonetheless.
Isn't he lovely?
All right, move on.
So before Jason and I start to talk about our top UFO stories of last week, I do want to tell you a little bit about our guest today, who is Dr. Bruce Maccabee. He's an optical physicist, or used to be, for the Navy for many, many years. And for decades, he's also been a UFO researcher. We had him on today in particular because these FBI UFO files have been in the news. And it was actually Dr. Maccabee who first put in a FOIA in the 70s to get these files released. So we might not even know about these files if it wasn't for his work a long, long time ago. And, of course, the media has been getting it completely wrong, saying this file was only released. I've seen stories where it says the file was only released recently or that it was released 2 years ago. But, no, it's been a long time that they've been out. So we're going to talk to Bruce about that. And interestingly, even though he believes, and we've talked about this before, but we'll talk about it with him, that this file's, you know, the result of a hoax, he says that there were some bigger implications that people have overlooked. So we're going to talk to Dr. Maccabee all about that, and it's going to be so exciting and wonderful. Speaking of exciting and wonderful, Jason, why don't we go ahead and talk about our top news stories from last week, and what is yours, my friend?
Well, I think I'm going to go with this brand new UFO exhibit that opened in Myrtle Beach called Encounters UFO Experience. Now, this exhibit was supposed to open on April 4th, but they had to delay their grand opening because I guess some of their exhibits didn't arrive in time, so they pushed it back a couple of days. But it did open on Saturday, and this exhibit, I'm pretty excited about this. These guys are doing something interesting. They were actually sponsors of our International UFO Congress this year, but these guys put together this exhibit, this kind of mini museum, and they claim that there are things like reproduction artifacts, original artifacts, documented film and recording, conceptual models, interactive experiences, and they based a lot of this stuff off reports of actual alien encounters. So it's fascinating what they put together. I'm excited to go there and see what they've actually got in this place, but they put it together in this sort of family-friendly exhibit like any other museum, but it's in this tourist area of Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and they put it in this the space or this area called Broadway at the Beach, and they put big exhibits in there, like the Bodies exhibit was the previous exhibit there. But they have this big exhibit space with this UFO exhibit, and on the building, they've got this huge UFO like crashing into the building. I don't know. It looks interesting. It looks like they've done some research. They spent 5 years researching and gathering the exhibits to put in this thing, and it's in a highly trafficked tourist area. So it'll be interesting to see what the response is from the public and just how well received it is. And I think their plan, after it has its stay in Myrtle Beach for I believe it's going through September, then they're taking it on the road. Supposedly going to be a nationwide sort of traveling museum thing. So that'll be interesting to see. And they plan to also have special lectures there, which is very similar to the Atomic Testing Museum in Las Vegas, their Area 51 exhibit. They have special UFO-related lectures there throughout the year. So this UFO Encounters, UFO Experience exhibit plans to do the same thing. And during their launch, they had Stanton Friedman come and give a presentation there. So I think it's great. I think it's great to put this subject in an environment like this where you're making it palatable for the general public, getting people to come in, exposing them to things that they might not have realized before and getting them to ask their own questions. So congratulations to those guys on launching this exhibit, and I can't wait till we get out there and check it out ourselves.
Yeah, it sounds interesting. I mean, there's potential there, but we'll see. So, because, I mean, I guess since we're researchers, you know, we're always looking for something new, but at least something that's presented well would be great. So, yeah, I can't wait to hear some feedback. I don't know. Have you heard from anybody who went to take a look? I haven't.
No, I haven't. I know that South Carolina is an interesting place for them to choose this, the Myrtle Beach area. A big part of their reasoning in selecting this for their launch is just the sheer number of sightings that happen all the time in Myrtle Beach. And we had a guest on Spacing Out, a guy named Joe Kiernan, who is in Myrtle Beach, in North Myrtle Beach, and he sees strange things in the sky on an almost daily basis and records video of these things. So there's a lot of unusual activity happening in Myrtle Beach, in the Myrtle Beach area. So that's interesting in itself. And I know he was invited to be at the grand opening. So I'll check in with him and see what his thoughts were on the exhibit. I've only seen a very small number of photos and video so far because it did just open this weekend, but I'll be very interested to hear from people who have actually gone there, and not just people casually exploring, just, you know, families on vacation, but, you know, people in the UFO field to see what their thought is and how this group has represented the subject and what sort of displays they have in there to intrigue the general public.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, Jason.
You bet.
So I want to mention my story, but I'm just going to make one comment on another, because there were really two that we kind of – one made a lot more of a splash than the other. But we did write about how for the citizens' hearing that Bassett's doing in Washington, D.C., that he did get some Congress members there, former Congress members. So that's interesting. I just won't talk much about it because I still don't know that that's going to have like any lasting impact or – be that big of a deal. But the story I want to talk more about that's making a lot of news, and we're going to have some more news on it today, which is really cool. So we've got some exclusive information on this that hasn't gotten out there yet, or at least to the American public. And that's this creature that is going to be part of the Sirius documentary that Stephen Greer is putting together.
And the name is Sirius. He's not just saying it's a serious
right.
documentary. It's serious. S-I-R-I-U-S.
Right, exactly. Thanks for clarifying.
You bet.
But, this what they're calling it is a humanoid of unknown classification. So they're being very careful not to call it an extraterrestrial. But they've got this carcass, a strange-looking carcass, that they say they got from Chile, and they say they have an impressive or eye-opening, is their term, group of medical professionals who have examined this thing, and that it's the DNA which has led them to this humanoid of unknown classification name for it. So it's a strange looking creature, and they finally released some pictures and they sent out a press release. I'm on their email list and they haven't emailed out this press release, surprisingly. So really, our story's gotten a lot of hits because I think we're the only ones who have written about this thus far. But we're going to write some more because Antonio, you know, luckily he has his South American connections there, has found that this story actually isn't as new as we thought, because I didn't, you know, we didn't have much of a background on this little thing. But when this was found in Chile, it was about 10 years ago. And it did hit the news out there. There was research done out there on this thing. Some Spanish millionaire, I guess, bought it and did some more research. So I don't have the details on that research right now, but Antonio's looking that up right now so we could get a story out hopefully today with more details behind what this South American investigation had found out about this weird humanoid thing. What do you think about this thing?
It's pretty interesting, I'll say that. And I will point out that our friend Lee Spiegel from the Huffington Post did publish a story about this little creature this weekend. So yeah, that story's up now. It's interesting, you know, to me, I mean, I'll reserve judgment until I see the supposed science they're going to present in this film. You know, they're making some bold claims and at the same time being very secretive and not saying much. So it'll be interesting to see the science that they present. And, you know, based on the trailer for the film so far and some of what I've seen, to me, it looks a lot like other hoaxes that we've seen in the past. I'm not going to say that this is a hoax, but, you know, it looks to have some signs of a hoax. And some people have pointed out that you have these super scientist doctor people working on this thing, yet in the video they're not wearing gloves or anything, so they're contaminating this creature. Some people have suggested that the head of it looks like nothing more than like a rosebud. Once you look at it, and you can see the similarities between that and a rosebud. It's interesting, and it's very tiny, this little tiny stick of a figure. So I don't know, and you're right, they're very careful not to call it an extraterrestrial or some sort of alien creature. Well, it would be an alien creature if it is just a new species here on Earth that they just discovered. But regardless, it's going to be interesting to see what they present, how they present it, and what their conclusions are.
Right, yeah, because, I mean, like you said, it is tiny. It's 6 inches. I know one of the things that they thought in Chile that it could be a fetus. I don't know how similar it looks to that, but it is really tiny. And I guess we should mention, I mean, this thing's getting all the news, but the documentary is about Stephen Greer's work, and it really kind of sounds like nothing new there. It's all about, you know, his disclosure project and how they feel that the government's hiding information about UFOs and back engineering, and that they actually do have some information about technologies that could get us off of fossil fuels and this kind of stuff like he's talking about for decades. But
yeah, and that's good to point out. And I don't want to be a downer here. I'm not going to dwell on it, but you know, to me, it's similar to Stephen Bassett's Citizens Hearing too. You know, is pushing this is something new and a major event that's going to get a lot of press coverage here. But like with the Greer thing, where the film is saying a lot of what's already been said by him for years, the Steve Bassett Citizens Hearing has all these people gathering to tell their UFO experiences or talk about UFOs and extraterrestrials here on Earth. All those people are regulars on the UFO conference circuit. You know, they're all the people that we've been hearing from for decades. So their statements are all public. They've all been said before. So it's not any new information. And Bassett's done things at the National Press Club before, and the media attention from that is very brief and short-lived. So,
and they typically make fun of it. So,
right, and you've got a panel of former Congress members listening to all this stuff, and these people aren't interested in the topic, and that's no secret. I mean, they specifically said that they have no interest in this topic. They're not required to ask questions. They're not required to do anything but sit there and listen. So will anything come out of it? I'm not sure. We'll see. I don't think much will come of it that hasn't already come of it, but wait and see.
Right. Yeah, they're almost just like three people from the public coming to, or five people now to,
yeah,
no different than anybody else. It's just that they're former, some very, very former Congress people. So yeah, good point. So we'll have to see. But I think one point is that if this, getting back to the little humanoid thing, if it's been around for 10 years in South America and there has been investigation on it there and it didn't really make any news because they didn't find anything significant, that also leads to some skepticism, although I think we're jaded, Jason. we've seen too many hoaxes come and go.
You know, that's a big possibility, and I try not to be jaded, but it's difficult. But like
it
I
is.
Said, I mean, I'm hopeful with all this stuff, so we'll wait and see what comes out of it. We'll wait and see how it's presented in the movie. We'll wait and see what happens with the citizens' hearing. I'm always hopeful.
We're hopeful. Hopeful jaded people. Hopefully jaded. All right. Well, there is the big news for the last couple of weeks. And, of course, you can go to our YouTube, or we also have it podcasts are spacing out for more UFO news. Of course.
And I will interrupt you for a second, Alejandro. I just want to point out, for any of you who haven't seen this little creature yet and would like to, we do have pictures on our website. So go to openminds.tv, and we do have the pictures on there. They're pretty interesting, so take a look if you're interested.
Really good point. Yeah, and they are, I mean, you can click on them to enlarge them. They're huge pictures. In fact, the picture's about 100 times bigger than the creature actually is. So you can see it in great detail. Good point. Spacing out, and then also we do have a Need to Know series on YouTube that Antonio's doing, where we have some information on the FBI stuff too. So a lot at our website, and it looks cool. We redid the website, and it looks awesome, huh?
Oh, yeah.
And I are really excited about that.
Yep, good-looking website.
All right. Well, without further ado, let's go ahead and get into our interview with Dr. Bruce McAbee. I am really happy to have on the show Dr. Bruce McAbee. Thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
Well, I'm glad you're having me, especially at this particular time, which has been a little bit of frustration for me.
Right.
And I'm referring to this FBI memo that's been around since 1977, was picked up a couple of years ago by tabloids, and there was a big flap that occurred. But this is a monster viral flap that just happened 5 days ago or 6 days ago or something.
Right, right, and that's what I wanted to talk about, because it's been just kind of surprising. I guess not so much that they picked up on the memo, but it was surprising to me how the FBI really made it a point to fix some of the misconceptions that happened when the media reported on this memo a couple years ago, but the media still just kind of ignored all of these points that the FBI tried to clarify and have still gotten everything wrong.
Yeah. Well, they have a separate file on Silas Newton, who was sort of the inspiration for this document that the FBI file contains. As I recall, if I recall correctly, it was the 5th of March of 1950 that Newton gave a talk at the University of Arizona or some college about...
I think it was University of Colorado Boulder, actually, which I have... I went to.
Which you went to, but you were too late. You were
I was
too
a little
late
too late, a few decades late.
Anyway, he talked about... flying saucers crashing in, I think, near Phoenix, Arizona, and bodies and stuff like that. And apparently that information knocked around somewhat. And it gets complicated because there's so many threads of discussion here. The Air Force, in its own investigations of flying saucers, and Project Cyan, Grudge, and Blue Book, Project Cyan and Grudge being involved in this situation because it occurred in 1950. And you have the idea that Mr. Newton was a con man, but he was into the oil business. In the oil business, they various people tried to devise devices to predict where there was going to be oil. I guess really the most successful system is where you set off explosions and you look at the sound waves that are bouncing back from what's underground and analyze that and decide where there could be pockets of oil. But electromagnetic devices were beyond the comprehension of most people back in those days. And as I understand it, Newton and another guy, Jabbar, were trying to sell what they call a doodle bug, a little electromagnetic device that you walk along over the ground and maybe it has needles on it or whatever that point to various symbols or whatever when you pass over an area where there's oil. Point being that these doodlebug type of things were used for, you know, wildcatters, guys who were just sort of almost randomly looking for oil, because everybody wanted to get liquid black gold, you know. And I guess Newton decided that if he could convince people that he had a doodlebug that was based on extraterrestrial physics.
Yeah, it's going to be better than the rest.
It'll be better than everybody else's. So he generates this story about crashed flying saucers. Whether that brought him any good fortune in terms of finding oil or not, we don't know. But we do know that apparently the FBI picked up on the story as told by Newton and filtered through several things. The document is not entirely clear as to how the FBI got the information.
Mm-hmm.
It says an investigator for the Air Force has reported, but it doesn't say who that was. And it doesn't say who he reported it to, but somehow the word got to the FBI. Now, we see a document written by Guy Hoddle. I've looked through a lot of FBI pages, like all of them.
Right.
1,600 sheets. And I know that very often what would happen is a report comes to the headquarters from some agent out in the field, and then it's rewritten, edited and rewritten before it's given to Hoover. So what we see by Guy Hoddle is most likely a rewritten version of whatever he received from the agent in charge at the time, or whoever picked up on this story. So we can't be sure that we're seeing exactly what
Hoddle wrote.
Exactly what the originator,
mm-hmm.
the guy on the field. We don't know exactly what he wrote, but what we know is what Hoddle wrote and sent directly to Hoover.
Now it's
the press picks up. The press always goes for the throat,
right?
And it picks up on the wild stuff. The importance of this document is not in its content so much as what it caused Hoover to do. But what it caused Hoover to do is not as jazzy and exciting as contemplating the idea that there were crash flying saucers with bodies and radar could shoot down flying saucers and stuff like that. The surprising thing about the present flap, I guess, is the seriousness with which the main media treated this, almost as if they thought, well, it might be true because it's in the FBI file.
Mm-hmm.
Without realizing that the FBI got garbage in their file as well as good stuff.
Right. And it's good you bring up, why Silas Newton, because I think that a lot of people wouldn't understand that. Okay, he's an oil man. He's kind of a con artist in the oil field, but why would he get into this whole UFO thing? But it shows how he could use this as part of his con, you know, saying, oh, I have extraterrestrial technology. That's why you got to go with me and why my technology for finding oil is better than anybody else's.
It doesn't even have to be extraterrestrial. It could be, he could argue that it was based on far advanced U.S. technology that the government is keeping secret.
Mm, right.
And the main point being, my doodlebug is better than your doodlebug, and here's why.
Right. Right. So I also find it interesting with this whole media flap on this story going on. Now, we try to, because we have a little more history, mention how you got these files in the 70s. Has any of these media sources called you? Not that many of them had even mentioned that these files were first retrieved in the 70s, and the FBI clarified that and said that in the story that they wrote that created this recent, excitement. But has any media called you to ask you about these files?
No. The closest that I have been has been a request to me for information was 2 years ago when the first flap occurred.
Mm-hmm.
Lynn Katai was going to be interviewed about this. Not that she knows anything about it particularly, but mm-hmm. she did the appropriate thing and called me up. Asked me what I knew about this document so that she could talk about it with some knowledge during her interview. She's the only person who has, in recent years, contacted me about this document, maybe the only person ever. I have to understand that this document has been in Well, first of all, I got it in the spring of 1977.
Uh-huh.
And at that time, I got over a period of months and years, I got a whole bunch of documents that were up to 1,600 pages, but about 400 and something of them were unique and interesting. Others were copies and newspaper clippings and stuff like that. And as part of the fund for UFO research, I decided to package these documents and sell them to make money for the fund. I also wrote articles that appeared in the MUFON Journal, International UFO Reporter, and what was the APRO Journal was called? Well, anyway, all three major UFO journals printed my articles, or a shortened version of it, on the FBI files within a year of when I got them, I guess. So the stuff's been out there
mm-hmm.
for a long time.
Right.
We sold documents, a package of documents, FBI, CIA, State Department, Air Force, stuff. The Fund for UFO Research did this in the 1980s, and you can't get them now because the Fund for UFO Research is basically defunct.
Right.
But they were available, and we sold hundreds of copies. This stuff has been around for a long time,
right?
As has this particular document. And those of us who have been studying the field were able to put the document into its proper context. And so we didn't go running off screaming, "Hey, we've got the proof, here's the smoking gun."
Did you do that immediately? Like, when you first read this document, when you got it back in the 70s, did you immediately say, "Wow, this is pretty much Silas Newton's story, I'm sure that's where this comes from"? Did you immediately make that connection?
Not me personally, but I was very circumspect about the document. I didn't go running around waving it and saying, "This is it."
Right.
Because it didn't say who was the source.
Mm-hmm.
It's an investigation. As a matter of fact, in the version that I got, I believe, if I recall correctly, the an investigator for Air Forces was crossed out. So you didn't really know where this document, where this information came from. And certainly, had that happened, you would have expected there would have been other stories. Now, we knew by the time I got the documents, we still didn't know about Roswell.
Right.
The Roswell crash had been buried in July of 1947 by General Ramey. And it's only half a handful of references to the Roswell case until 1979. So at the time I got the FBI documents, the only document referring to Roswell in the FBI file was there, but so what? Nobody cared. And then this document from 1950 talking about crash flying saucers without any source for the information sounded very suspect, because so far as we knew up until 1979, there weren't any crash flying saucer reports.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you make of that Silas Newton? Do you think it was kind of dumb luck? I mean, he talked about in the 50s crash UFOs, and one or two of those being in New Mexico. And this is prior to 3 years after the Roswell incident, but prior to, like you said, really the general public or anybody really knowing about Roswell before Friedman and Moore had broken it open in the 80s.
There have been lots of UFO sightings, and apparently, according to research done by Bill Moore in the 1980s, now Bill Moore was strongly involved with Roswell, but he also checked up on the so-called Aztec crash.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with Roswell, he pointed out that with Roswell, the more people he talked to, the stronger the case got. When it came to the Aztec crash, he couldn't find anybody.
Right.
And the more, the harder they looked, the weaker the case got.
Yeah.
Now, some people have picked up on it since Steinman in his book in the 1980s, and Ramsey more recently. But apparently, according to Jerry Clark's UFO Encyclopedia, which I use as a reference, apparently there were some Hollywood attempts to come up with a UFO film in 1949. And some sort of a public argument was waged over this. I don't remember exactly the details. But apparently Newton heard about it, and that sort of gave him the spark of the idea. There had been lots of saucer reports, so why not a crash flying saucer?
Mm-hmm.
This is quite independent of Roswell. Whether he knew about Roswell or not, I don't know. But the idea that there might be one crash was sort of in the air.
Mm-hmm.
The Air Force was certainly looking for something that might crash, so they'd have hardware to investigate.
Right.
You have to understand that in the history of this subject, there is the conventional open literature history, and then there's the unconventional closed literature history. And the closed literature history centers around the Roswell crash that, if real, I suspect it was, all the information is being held close to everybody's chest. But the only people who knew about it were cleared for top secret and didn't tell anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a history of Roswell stuff going on, but nobody knew about it. You couldn't document it in the open literature.
Right.
Nowadays, you can document a lot of stuff in the open literature because a lot of stuff. As a matter of fact, nowadays we know more about what happened in the early days, in the 40s and 50s.
Right.
Than we did back in the 60s and 70s.
Right. Well, and you know, these files are kind of an example of that, where researchers, UFO researchers such as yourself in the 70s, I mean, you had to go digging and send letters and get these paper files and go through books. And whereas nowadays we have, and thanks to you and a lot of these, we have all of these files at our fingertips. We can just go on the internet and look up FBI UFO, and we have all these files to view.
Right.
So what was kind of your inspiration back then to do these FOIA requests for the FBI?
I'm glad you're bringing that up, because I was just about to say the fact that I got the FBI documents was a fluke. I didn't know that there were any FBI documents. The only reference that I recall to the FBI in the open literature was in Ruppelt's book written in 1955, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects. Ruppelt was a guy from Edward Ruppelt, who was the head of Project Blue Book for several years, from the fall of 1951 until he retired in 53, I think it was. He wrote a book based on the documents that had been collected by the Air Force up to that time. And in his book, he says, he made a one-sentence statement that the FBI was not involved in flying saucer research. And the FBI is primarily a criminal investigating unit, so there was no reason to suspect that they would be involved. So the only thing that made me think otherwise was during my investigation of the Trent case. Trent photos, McMinnville, Oregon, May 1950, probably the most famous UFO photos in the world, because I'm sure they've been published more than any other UFO photos, starting way back in the 50s. And so this is now the middle 70s, and I'm investigating the Trent case, and Paul Trent says that FBI men came and visited him and talked to him, interviewed him a week or a couple of weeks after the photos had been published. There was no independent confirmation of what Mr. Trent said. I did some investigation, talked to the guy who was the photo editor of the McMinnville paper, the telephone register at the time. He was the person who actually got the negatives from the Trent's house and published on stuff in the papers. He told me that two investigators from the Air Force came and came to the newspaper a couple of weeks after the photos were published and demanded all copies of the photos and the negatives. He didn't have the negatives. He had sent them to the API, UPI, or International News Service, I guess it was at that time. So he couldn't cough up the negatives, fortunately. But he did. He said they had the paper to prove that they had the right to take all the pictures, the copies, and so on. But that wasn't the FBI. That was the Air Force, according to this other guy, Bill Powell, who was the photo editor of the paper. Nevertheless, I decided to write to the FBI and see under this new Freedom of Information Act. It was then new. It went into effect in 75, and I was writing this in 76. And I said, I'd like to know if Paul Trent was ever interviewed by the FBI or words to that effect. And then I put in as a sort of a side thought, and oh, by the way, if there are any other UFO documents, I'd like to know. Well, I filed this in October of 1976. 2 or 3 weeks later, I get a letter saying, yeah, your request is number 36,422 or something like that. And I thought, well, I'll probably hear from him in the next century. To my great surprise, I got a phone call at work. When I was working for the Navy, I got a phone call at work from a very surprised FBI agent in May of 1977, I think it was. In any case, he told me that he had been very surprised. He had been asked to handle my request. They had put a whole bunch of agents on this job of handling Freedom of Information Act requests, and of course they got a lot of requests for information on all sorts of people. But this is a request by me. It was the first one related to UFOs. And he said he had read through. There were 1,600 pages of stuff. Most of it was not worthwhile, he thought. But he was willing to give me a sample of the best pages, which turned out to be about 466 copies. I can't remember now whether they asked me to pay for them or not. In some cases, the FLRA, the Freedom of Information Act request, resulted in a request for money to pay for copying, like 10 cents a page, and they have 1,000 pages. Sorry, I can't afford that. UFO investigators aren't rich.
Right.
But anyway, the point is, he sent 400 pages. These had all been censored, or largely censored, in the sense that they crossed. They made a copy of the original. Then they blanked out the names that they thought shouldn't be associated with the Freedom of Information Act request. It's the Freedom of Information Act, FOI, and Privacy Act, FOIPA. And the privacy part is that people whose names appear in the documents, if they're not officially involved, like government workers or something, can be erased. So I get a series of copies with names removed, but in most cases I was able to figure out what the names were. Anyway, in a lot of cases they accidentally left the name in some places.
You're right.
Anyway, I got these documents in May or so of 1977, and started, or they come in a jumbled form. They're not in historical order. I don't know about the ones that they've got on the internet right now, whether that's in historical order or if it's just jumping randomly filed. But anyway, I went through, picked out documents that were definitely associated with the headquarters of the FBI, documents that had to do with investigations of UFO sightings and other things that might be of interest, and also a file of things that weren't of interest at all, it didn't seem to be. I started writing about them, this package of documents, and that's when I, over the following year, wrote a very large multi-part article that took up several sizable chunks of several of each of the UFO journals that published it.
What did you, obviously you didn't think too much of the Guy Hoddle memo, but what were some of the pieces, that files you found in the FBI files that were of interest to you that you thought were more significant?
I wrote a book about this.
Right.
Much later. I got the documents in 77. A book editor at the time offered suggested that I just simply take the documents and publish them. But I always wanted to be more scientific about it. I wrote up, tried to put these documents in a historical context. And like I said, by 1980 or so, virtually the heart of the documents had been published. In 1995 or so, middle 1990s, The X-Files was one of the hot top-rated TV shows. And I was living in the Washington, D.C. area, and I read in Washington, D.C. Sunday Weekly magazine, there was a story about this lady who, story about a lady who was a tour guide in the FBI headquarters. And she was writing about her experiences with the FBI, and she said that one of the first things people would ask when they came in for a tour was, can we see the X-Files? And she said, "But well, we had tried to convince them there were no X-Files." And I said to myself, these people don't even know what they got.
Right.
Because guess what? A number of the documents in the early years are marked Security Matter -X, the real X-Files. So anyway, I saw that, and I said, this has got to be, this demands a book. So with a lot of faltering missteps along the way and so on, I managed to get a book published in 2000 called The UFO FBI Connection, which combines not just the UFO documents, but the not just the FBI documents related to UFOs, but really the whole history involving the Air Force, where the FBI has an input, and the FBI acted like a black hole and collected information you can't even find in the FBI, in the Air Force file.
Hmm.
Air Force intelligence files were used, and the last chapter is the CIA. So I put them all together in this book. It shows that the Air Force was like a split personality. On the one hand, they would be telling the public that there was nothing to it. We're handling the problem. We're investigating. We're not finding anything. But to the inside, there were real questions going on. And the FBI, the really important FBI documents, in my opinion, came in the summer and fall of 1952. But as far as this present document is concerned, it caused Hoover to do something. The day after Hoover got this document, he writes back to, I don't know, Guy Hoddle or somebody. He had some agents that were liaison with the Air Force intelligence and the Pentagon. So he asked his FBI agent, go to the Air Force and ask them what they really think of the flying saucer situation. Is it real or not? What do they really think? Get me some info. And you might well ask, why in the world did Hoover do that? You know, why did he care what the Air Force thought, you might say, but even if it was just an interest on his own, you want to know the way he phrases the his question. It sounds like he's confused.
Hmm.
And there's a good reason for it, as I discovered by putting the whole history of this stuff together. Let me see here. I'm actually looking at the document. Guy Hoddle's message was a copy that he sent to Hoover was on March 22, 1950. On March 23. Hoover asked David Ladd, who was like his second in command, a question, and Ladd responds on the 23rd of March. References made to your inquiry on the attached routing slip. Quote, just what are the facts regarding flying saucers? A short memo as to whether it is true or just what the Air Force thinks of them. And so Ladd or some special agent, S.W. Reynolds, who was the Air Force liaison with the FBI, went and talked to a couple of guys in the Pentagon, Major Boggs and Colonel Hearn. And he was told the Air Force had discontinued the intelligence project to determine what flying saucers are in the latter part of the previous year, which is December of 1949. That's supposedly approximately when Project Sign ended and Project Grudge began. But Reynolds and the FBI was not told that the project was still going on after all. It was told, what the public was told, namely that the Air Force had discontinued the project because most of the cases could be explained They said 3/4 of the incidents regarding flying saucers proved to be misidentifications of a wide variety of things. So, bottom line is, the FBI Hoover was being told that the Air Force had concluded there was nothing to it. And this comes in early 1950. And you might ask, well, why was Hoover acting like he was confused? And the answer is, you go back to the very beginning. We have June 24th, 1947. You got Kenneth Arnold's sighting, and it's reported on June 25th in newspapers all over the United States. And in the following couple of weeks, following 3 weeks in particular, there's a huge flap of sightings. The Air Force immediately was queried as to what's going on, you know, what's up in the air, and they said, whatever it is, official statement by the Air Force is, whatever it is, it's not ours. That leaves are open for being Russian.
Hmm.
Nobody, a few people were thinking in terms of extraterrestrial at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, in July 10th of 1947, the Air Force contacted the FBI and asked the set up a meeting with the FBI and asked the FBI to investigate, to check out the possibility of subversive practices going on. Some activities of the Soviet Union designed to remove from the American public the confidence that the Air Force can control the skies, or something like that. In other words, spurious sightings being generated to cause panic in the population. So the FBI, of course, was into conspiracies and confronting the Soviets and all that. So Hoover said, yeah, he would do a famous, at the end of this memo, where, first of all, in this typed part of the memo, you see Agent Reynolds, the Air Force liaison with the FBI, being told by General George Shulgin, who was head of the requirements branch of Air Force Intelligence, being told by Shulgin that they're using all their scientific experts to run down these flying saucer reports and find out what's going on. It would be clear from this memo that something was, they think something really is happening. It's not all a figment of somebody's imagination. And they asked the FBI to investigate. And Clyde Tolson commented on this memo that he didn't think we should get involved with it. Tolson, you remember, was Hoover's good buddy. His very good buddy. Very, very good buddy. And Hoover, nevertheless, responded, I would do it, but in the L.A. case, this is capital L, small a with a period, L.A. case, the Army grabbed it before we had a chance to examine it. I must insist on he starts off his memo by saying, I would do it, but I must insist upon full access to all disks recovered. So, evidently, Hoover's idea is if there's hardware involved, they might be able to track it to its source, and its source might be in the Soviet Union, or they might track it to communist sympathizers in the United States. But anyway, the FBI did get involved, and the Air Force was clearly considering this as a serious thing. And for a couple of months, the FBI actually did investigate, interview people who were involved, about 24. And that material, of course, is in the FBI file, the people that they interviewed. And then they found out that the Air Force had actually brought in the FBI to track down useless stuff. The terminology, ash can covers and toilet seats, was used as things that were supposedly designated as flying saucers. And when Hoover heard that, he said, we're out. And from September of 1947 on until into 1948, the FBI file was very thin. But then the FBI nevertheless acted like a black hole and collected stuff from the Air Force. One of the things they collected was in the fall of 1949 or 1948, there was a beginning of a series of things that have been called green fireballs. The green fireball reports, nobody doubted that they were green fireballs. They were seen by hundreds of people. So it was very strange that they were seen to be localized over the southwestern United States. the FBI didn't do anything about this per se, but they saw what was happening, and of course Hoover could see things, stories in the newspapers and so on. Then in the end of 1949, no, the beginning of 1949, Hoover got a an interview of an Air Force colonel who said that he thought that the Air Force was working on this problem, but they thought that these things were actually atomic missiles movement from the Soviet Union. And shortly after that, the FBI gets 50 copies of a what would be considered a prototype sighting form. All the things that you want to know about some object that some people have, some person has sighted. Sighting forms, there were 50 of them, so the FBI could send a sighting form to each of the 50 offices, local offices of the FBI. Clearly, the Air Force was taking this seriously to go to all that work. And that's in early 49. And there were green fireball sightings throughout 1949. Yeah, many of them took place at secure installations, where the FBI also had people tracking potentially subversive activities at these installations like Los Alamos, Killeen Base in Texas, and stuff like that. So the FBI would clearly get the impression that the Air Force was taking this seriously. And yet in the news, the Air Force is always poo-pooing the whole thing. The Project Sign report, when it came out, in the late spring of 1949, the Project Sign was published as quote, Project Saucer, unquote. Pointed out most of the sightings could be explained, but did imply that there was some sightings that couldn't be explained, and they're still working on them.
And if I remember, in Ruppelt's book, he mentioned that they had taken it very seriously and really hadn't come to any conclusion on the green fireballs either.
Right. The green fireball stuff had a disc variation in terms of sightings, according to a guy who compiled a whole bunch of sighting lists. But anyway, the point is that the Air Force, on the one hand, was treating it seriously, secretly treating it seriously, but publicly poo-pooing the whole thing. So here Hoover is getting it from both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And this document that pops up in 1950 sort of brings it to a head, where Hoover says, well, it's about time the Air Force told me the true clue. And what happens? The cover-up starts here. Well, it didn't start here, but here's the cover-up going on. The Air Force says there's nothing to it, even though Hoover's gotten in the previous months and years all sorts of information from the Air Force that indicates the Air Force is treating it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now I'm going to jump ahead to 1952. By 1952, the Air Force, as I said, the FBI was acting like a black hole for information. They weren't doing anything with the sightings. If they got a sighting report, they turned it over to the Air Force. But the Air Force was sending them stuff anyway, and they were attending top secret meetings of intelligence. Several intelligence groups that might be involved in particular protection of vital installations, with the terminology, protection of vital installations, making sure the Russians didn't compromise the security of our nuclear weapons and so on. So 1952 will go down as the year of the UFO. Thousands of sightings throughout the United States, thousands of sighting reports. The Air Force collected some 2,000 sightings in that one year, I think. About 1,500 objects were seen, they deduced from their data. And the climax of this came in late July, when there were sightings over Washington, D.C. and picked up by Washington, D.C. radar, and some people saw some lights in the sky and stuff like that. On two weekends, on the second weekend, it was apparently too much for the Air Force. There were sightings from all over the United States, filtering into the Project Blue Book file. They were being flooded with reports coming in faster than they can analyze them. And on the 29th of July, after the second weekend of Southern Draw at Washington, D.C., the top general, General Vandenberg, directed his Air Force Intelligence General, Samford, John A. Samford, to hold a press conference and sort of explain what was going on as best he could. And Samford held this press conference starting at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It was reported to be the largest press conference since the beginning of the Korean War, which was going on at this time, by the way. Here we are, looking like another Korean War.
Right.
So you better keep your eyes on the skies. And maybe a bunch of flying saucers coming out. Anyway, so Samford gets up in front of the mass of newspaper reporters. Every news organization was being represented because all the major newspapers throughout the United States had carried stories about sightings, not just single-person sightings, but multiple witnesses and stuff like that. Samford gets up there and says, we've gotten about 1,000, 1,500 or something, I forget the exact numbers that he quoted, sightings, and most of which we've been able to explain to our satisfaction. But there are some that are incredible reports by credible people, to paraphrase what he said. And they're still working on it. Well, now, while but basically he was poo-pooing the whole thing. He said, in his opinion, this is all natural weather phenomena that were being reported or misidentified. This is what he's telling the press. Thanks to the FBI, we now know that was not the internal opinion of the Air Force. On the same day that Samford is passing his information to the press, the FBI liaison got over to Air Force Intelligence to find out what the heck was really going on, these sightings over Washington, D.C., apparently, and the big press flap over all the sightings throughout the United States caused the FBI wonder what the hell was going on once again. And they sent this agent over to the Pentagon, and he talked to a Commander Boyd, who was a Navy connection to Air Force Intelligence Project on flying saucers. And Boyd tells the FBI agent that, it's true that most of the sightings can be explained, but like 2 to 3% of the sightings cannot be explained. And because of this, some top-level Air Force officials are seriously considering the possibility of interplanetary ships. Now, if Samford, at his press conference, had said, yes, we're also considering the possibility of interplanetary ships, it would have blown the lid off right there. But that's not what Samford said. Now, it's interesting this occurs in one document in the FBI file written in July 29, 1952, that the Air Force, some top Air Force officials are considering interplanetary ships. What makes it even more interesting is that in October of 1952, there's an FBI document discussing the reaction of the Air Force to a movie made by a photographer, the Newhouse film. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Newhouse was traveling through Utah and he and his wife saw these strange objects approaching, and he ran to the trunk of his car to get out. He was a Navy photographer. He had a movie camera available. By the time he gets the movie camera out, the objects are so far away you can't really see any structure, but you can see them moving, and he films them, and Navy analysts of his film were not able to explain it. And this document in the FBI file is referring to that film analysis, and it says once again that some top Air Force officials are seriously considering the possibility of interplanetary ships. So now we know from the FBI file that as early as the 1950s, the Air Force knew what was going on, shall we say. And this is quite independent, by the way, of Roswell. Obviously, anybody who was aware of the Roswell stuff had the answer as to whether or not these things are real.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm saying you can make that same argument without knowing anything about Roswell.
Right.
Because there was enough other information filtering around. As I wrote the book, I was continually amazed at how the Air Force was trying to brainwash itself, in a sense, into believing that there was nothing to flying saucers, or if at the most they were, on the one hand, they would argue that they were possibly a Russian device, where the Russians had managed to leapfrog our technology by tens of years, at least. On the other hand, they couldn't believe that the Russians could have gotten that far ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
So they were caught in a paradox, a paradoxical situation, sort of. They didn't have the sightings, and if you believe the sightings were true, people were seeing these things doing aerodynamics that we couldn't do. It clearly indicated a technology beyond our own. The only other nations on Earth that could have the possibility of generating such technology was the Russians. So it must be Russian atomic power plant, Russian atomic powered craft that they're flying over the United States. But the counter argument was, hey, if we had top secret aircraft of those capabilities, do you think we would fly them over Russia? What if one crashed?
Right.
And then they got the information on how to build it. So several times in the records you can find where the Air Force analysts would use the Russian explanation as a, you might say, a foil, a straw man, to indicate that they thought the sightings were real. They must have had some sort of source of the sightings. They were indicating real advanced technology, and it wasn't ours, so it had to be Russian. But this is a tongue-in-cheek type explanation, where Russian is like a code word for extraterrestrial.
Mm. Well, and that's what's interesting about delving into this period of time in particular, because we have, you know, more insight, like you said, we have more visibility into it now than we ever had before. And you could see the struggles going on and grappling with this issue. But then you can also see how, you know, a lot of people took very serious the idea that possibly these things were extraterrestrial.
Right. Well, according to Ruppelt, especially in his private notes that were never published until after his death, General Garland, who was one of the people involved in Air Force intelligence that was on top of the UFO problem, Ruppelt says that the top-level opinion, the opinion that UFOs were extraterrestrial, was such a strong top-level opinion was almost Air Force policy. But, of course, the Air Force policy didn't go to the point of implying that these things were even real, the official publicized policy.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that Ruppelt knew this was because he said that General Garland, who was in charge of the Air Force intelligence related to this flying saucer, was one of the people who had his own sighting and was a strong ET man.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. The FBI document squares with what Ruppelt had said.
Right. All right. Well, your book is available. We're about out of time. People can still get your book. I know, like, Abe's Books. Abe Books is one of my favorite sites to get books that are older that are out there. But I think it might still – is it still on Amazon?
Yeah, it's on Amazon, probably on other used book collections.
Right.
And then I published 7,000 of them. If I had 100,000 of them available in the last year or so, I probably could have sold them all.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah. And hopefully this sparks some new interest into it, because it's important stuff. But I'm sure the best book on the FBI files. But I guess my last question is, what do you think about this, the media, how wrong they've been getting this story? I mean, it doesn't seem like they bother to do their due diligence when it comes to these kind of stories.
Well, yeah, I don't know why it suddenly went viral and impressed the major news media so much.
Mm-hmm.
other than it was an amusement for them. Now, I heard the FBI historian being interviewed on one of the news shows, and he gave some history, but he didn't point out that the really important thing about this document is what it caused Hoover to do.
Right.
Try to find out from the Air Force what was going on, and Hoover gets stuck to Hoover. he doesn't get the true clue. It's the Air Force covering itself up. You know, one of the strongest reasons that UFOs haven't been accepted generally is what I call a self-cover-up. You don't want to know this is real, so you don't pay any attention to it, or you treat it as a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of like what the general major press does.
Right.
They didn't really look into the context of this document. Why did it show up in the FBI file in the first place? Why in the world does the FBI have a whole bunch of files related to UFOs?
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't anybody pick up on the term X-Files? I sent a copy of, let's see, who was the guy who, what's the name of the guy who was the director for the X-Files?
Chris Parker?
Yeah, I sent him a copy of my book. Never heard any response from it.
Huh.
So I said, you are very... You're very correct in talking about an X-File, because there really was one.
And then he never calls. And that's what's interesting. Like you said, it's a big story, but really, I mean, giving you a call and like having a conversation like the one we've just had, the story is a lot bigger and more interesting than what they're printing, and they could have that story if they just gave you a call.
Yeah, right.
Or picked up your book. That's unfortunate.
Well, I'm going to see if I can get it converted into an e-book. I haven't heard
that
of it. The well-known publishing company published the book in 2000. They sold out within a few years. I haven't heard anything from them since.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about this with me. I mean, this stuff is just so incredibly fascinating, and the real story, you know, behind the memo is much more interesting than the simple memo itself, and especially with it, it's where it comes from. But thank you so much for sharing this and getting it out there. And it's also, for me, it's great to get this information out there too, so people know, you know, what the true story is, and that you can get credit for the amazing work you've done that really led to the file being out there.
Well, I appreciate you calling me up and letting me talk.
Yeah, thank you so much. All right. Thank you to Dr. Maccabee. What a great interview. Some really interesting, important stuff. It just blows my mind that the media hasn't called this guy. He's the one they need to talk to. For goodness sakes, he got the files released. What's their problem? Check out his book, FBI UFO Connections. Definitely a must-have for people interested in UFOs. You can find it online. Try Abe Books. I saw there's some there. I think there might be some left on Amazon, but it's out of print, as he said, so it's something to look for. Also, you can find his research, and he's got a lot of great research, at brumac.8k.com. That's brumac.8k.com. So, speaking of great stuff, don't forget to check out OpenMinds.tv for the latest UFO news. You can see the spacing out videos there, the need to know videos, and everything that we're up to. And next week, I actually know who we're talking to, and this is really exciting. Gary Whitta, who is actually a screenplay writer. He does lots of stuff. He works on games. He wrote for Futurama and some other cool things like that. But more recently, he wrote the screenplay for The Book of Eli, and actually we're talking to him more about him writing with M. Night Shyamalan the screenplay to After Earth movie coming out here soon. So we've got an exclusive interview with Gary Whitta, the writer of After Earth. So this is going to be a lot of fun, and he's going to talk to us about, among other things, of course, extraterrestrials in sci-fi and stuff like that. So we will talk to you next week. Adios, amigos.